Hello?
Hey, Jimmy, thought you were going to freeze me out there.
What do you mean?
You didn't pick up when I called you.
I tried.
How's it going?
Doing all right. How's it going for you?
All right. Sorry.
Well, that's good news.
Hey, Jamie, welcome to Better Call Saul in season 3.
Thank you.
It's been more than a year.
I know. It's crazy.
Jamie, this is West Coast Project. Saul, Better Call Saul 301, Mabel.
That's right.
How did you like this episode, Jamie, from Georgia?
Mike. Okay, so, you know, all right, I love this show. I think it's very well written. I happen to like the Mike part of the story more than I like, you know, the other parts of the story. But I thought that the opening was fantastic. And I think that Gene is like better looking than Jimmy or Saul.
Yeah, that amazes me. I would wonder what our other female listeners would say about Gene being the attractive Jimmy Saul Gene trio.
Because I'll tell you what it is. It's like his.
It's terrible. His unending access to Cinnabons.
Perhaps, you know, I'm on a diet, so maybe that's what it is. But no, I mean, you know, I love the way his cheekbones look, because he's got this kind of like sunken look to his face, and he's got like the shades on, or you know, whatever, and it just they. He just looks so cool. I don't know. It's real sexy.
Yeah, Gene is my favorite character in this, not because he looks sexy, but because of his role in what becomes of Jimmy.
Right. I mean, it's just amazing. Like, at this point for me, it doesn't even seem like the same person.
Yeah, he's not the same person. There's three people here. Jimmy, Saul, and Gene.
Yeah.
Totally. Look how different Gene is from Jimmy.
Yeah, I mean, it's like night and day. It's really like night and day. Those two people are not the same person. And it's crazy because, like, even if you think about Saul, Gene is nothing like Saul. I mean, that's amazing.
All right, Jamie, well, let's catch up a little bit here. So, first of all, Gilligan and Gould co-wrote this first episode. Peter Gould and Vince Gilligan. Tom Schnauz wrote the second one, and Gilligan directed both episodes. So we know we're in good hands with the storytelling of these first two episodes.
That's pretty great.
And if we have to recap a little bit about last season, we have to remember Chuck has taped Jimmy, his confession about the editing of the documents from the Mesa Verde project.
Right.
And it's kind of a memory, or it's a reminder that Jimmy's actions have reactions. And maybe there's no better proof than that of Saul becoming Gene. That he sets up, he makes his own bed and has to sleep in it.
That's right. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that particularly in this episode, but also, of course, as, you know, just a big old hunk and part of Jimmy Saul Gene's life, you know, the stuff that he does, it really does have consequences, and, it, you know, he's going to answer for his actions.
Yeah, that's hammered into us. Now, Gene, obviously, we see that as the very first part of the episode, first part of the season. But also the Air Force major comes in and reminds them, like, there's going to be hell to pay later on. The wheel turns. There's actions. There's reactions to your actions.
Right, right. And the captain is really not. He's not happy.
So some other thoughts I had, Jamie, that Kim really loves Jimmy. She really does love Jimmy. And she's got a little bit of a dark side to her. She loves his con man persona, joining in on him with him on some of those capers even. In seasons past.
Yeah, I agree. I think that she is kind of charmed by that. And that was one of the real surprises for me of last season, is the fact that she was willing to get down in the dirt with him.
So there's no Kim at all in Breaking Bad. So we kind of have this mystery in front of us. Whatever happens to Kim?
Yeah.
And she's so important now in Jimmy's life that it's very fascinating that she never even makes a blip on the map, in on the radar in Better Call, in Breaking Bad. And she, right now, she's the total buffer. She's like more than that. She's like, shit, she's like a retaining wall between Jimmy and full-blown Saul.
Yeah, okay, so I don't think of it as being like she's, you know, like, oh man, what happened to her? I'm curious about like how she ends up out of his life, but you know, like this wasn't, Saul wasn't an idea when Breaking Bad, you know, started, and so Kim could have never been an idea, and then, you know, they didn't know they were going to do a spinoff until very late in the series, and so I just don't think that there was ever an opportunity to have a Kim. But, you know, but having said that, I think that however she completely absents herself from his life, because that's really what, you know, that's what it is. Like, you know, there is no Kim in his life at this, at during the years of Breaking Bad that we know of. So if she's really gone, then I don't know. And we used to speculate about like what happened to her. Did she die? Did he kill her? What happened? But I think she's just gone. Like, she's probably just, like, had quite enough of his antics. And, you know, it's just like, dude, I'll never speak to you again.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. It's I don't even know what to project happens to Kim. I hope nothing bad. But it's also interesting, if you note the Gene setting at Cinnabon, he has a Kansas City lunchbox or bag or something, and that's where she's from. And he's way into the future here, and he's still, like, clinging on to Kansas City. And for all we know, Saul has nothing to do, or Jimmy has nothing to do to connect him to Kansas City other than Kim.
Yeah, that's true, which could be, so, like, his thing of, like, taking his love with him, you know?
Yeah, maybe. or leaving the door open for a reunion of some sort.
Or maybe, yeah, maybe.
All right, so we get this. All right, so there's spoilers all over. I was going to say there's no spoilers. There's spoilers all over our podcast here, Jamie. Breaking Bad spoilers, and for what we know about and can hint about Better Call Saul, of course the implication is Gus is going to show back up.
Of course.
If you watch the Nextons, Gus, they're at Pollo Hermanos. Gus's face shows up. The whole note on the dashboard and the whole reason why somebody's slowing Mike down from shooting the Salamancas.
Hector.
It's Gus, right? It's got to be Gus. Gus wrote the note to slow down, or made the call to slow down the Salamanca cousins from killing Walt.
Mm-hmm.
Why is Gus, what does Gus gain by slowing down Mike's actions towards the cartel?
Always the same thing. It's always with Gus, there are three. There are three motivations. One of them is secrecy, like keep everything low profile, keep it on the down low, because he wants to hide in plain sight. So that's number one motivation. Number two motivation for Gus is always money. And so if there is a percentage in keeping the status quo, then, you know, then he is going to do that. And then, you know, like his third motivation, if you really want to think of it, you know, in that sense, is that he doesn't want to take risks. Like, he wants the risk that he takes to be controlled to the greatest degree possible. And if Mike goes and kills, you know, Hector or anybody in that clan, it's not going to be a controlled risk. It's going to be a war. And, you know, there goes his anonymity. There goes his ability to sock away his cash. And there goes his safety. So, you know.
Yeah, that's a really good take. That's a really good reminiscence of Gus from Breaking Bad, and that's a really good take on probably what's happening. He's a man of honor. He's a freaking criminal, but he's a man of honor. Like a man provides for his family. That's what he maintains most above all other things. And you're right, he does minimize risk, and he does hide in plain sight. So any things that compromise that, he tries to tamp them down.
Yeah.
So I think you nailed it. That's what that note's probably all about.
Thanks.
And Mike knows his limits. He knows that he's up against somebody pretty freaking powerful. And I think that he senses that when he sees this note, and he doesn't know right away where it came from and how did he track me? How did he find me? Like, he knows that this adversary is as equal or greater to him than he thinks.
Well, I mean, that was the thing that was just so damn crazy, because like last season, you and I talked about how weird it was that like Mike was out there, like alone, completely alone. And then there was that moment where all of the crickets fell silent, and Mike did not notice that the silence had happened, like that all the crickets had stopped making noise. And I noticed it while I was watching the episode and was like, oh my God, there's somebody there. It was very horror movie-esque. And, but he didn't notice until later. And you and I speculated that was the moment that whoever showed up, you know, at that moment and put that note, that was what made the crickets go silent, you know. But Mike was there with his back turned. I mean, whoever it was really could have just killed Mike, because, you know, not that they wanted to, but I'm saying like they could have, because he was not aware of his surroundings at that moment.
Yeah.
Like, he was completely absorbed in trying to get his shot, you know, and then he goes up to the car after, you know, he gives it up and he realizes he's not going to get a shot, and then sees that note. And the thing that was different, like, this season when they kind of redid that scene, was like how livid he was. He looks around and he's like mad, like angry, you know, and he takes off speeding and he's like trying to get, you know, out of there. And I was wondering, like, why are you speeding? Are you speeding because you're angry, or are you speeding because you don't know who put that note? You don't know if they're still there. You don't know if they're going to take a shot at you. You don't know, like, anything.
Did you do a rewatch, Jamie, or are you just remembering all the stuff?
No, I'm remembering all this stuff.
No, I'm serious, because I did not remember all. I didn't even know what freaking Mike was doing out there in the desert till you reminded me. This is great. I didn't do a rewatch either, so I'm kind of winging it from 301 forward here.
Oh yeah, no, I remember all that stuff.
So Jamie, when I heard that the show Better Call Saul was going to be a show, I was like, oh, come on, get the fuck out of here. Breaking Bad was perfect. Just leave it alone. Let it be great. Let it, you know, fade away into history. But I got to admit, when Saul came on, I'm like, okay, this is a bit of a way to still kind of cling a little bit to the greatness of Breaking Bad. I can remember how fun it was to watch. But this show, to me, Jamie, this show has become a great, great show in and of itself.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, you know, I don't think it could have made it past the first season if it had not been as special as it is. It is it's a fantastic show. I mean, you know, that and for me, for a word person, like I'm a writer, and I've always been a writer. Even before I was a professional writer, I was a writer in my life, and I have tremendous respect, you know, for the word. And I treat Microsoft Word like an enemy that I know very well. I've tamed it. I've made it my bitch. But I was talking about like actual words. But no, I mean like I have real respect for words and language and you know, poetry and prose and, you know, like all of it. And normally for me, like a, you know, a TV show is really about the language, but there are a couple of programs that, are on television that the language, the visual aspect of it is just as important as the language for me. And Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul and The Americans are three series for that, like for me, the visuals are just as often stunning, you know? The shots, like there's this one that I want to talk about this episode with Mike that just blew my mind. I mean, it was fantastic, you know, and you know it was art. Like somebody set that shot up and just made it amazing. And so we can talk like when we get to it, but I don't know. It's great.
Yeah, well, that certainly helps the whole process. This great creative team of Vince Gillian and all his editors and photographers and the music and all the time-lapse photography and, you know, everything. This, the writers. But, you know, if you think about Breaking Bad, who freaking cared who Jimmy's girlfriend was in Breaking Bad? You know, he's trying to jump Francesca's bones, the secretary in the front desk all the time. But that was just a joke. But this whole thing with Kim, like, this is just totally appealing.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, that she loves him and, you know, and he loves her and, you know, they seem, you know, like a, actually, okay, so I'll put it to you this way. They seem like a doomed couple, you know, like they really do. They seem like, you know, perfect together and like they could really be in love. But also that there is no future for them because the things that are deal breakers for Kim are things that are part of Jimmy's character.
Yeah, except for a couple little teasing things that overlap. Like who would have thought that Kim, straight-laced Kim, would go in for these scams in the bar with the fooling people about investments and stuff?
Yeah, right. You're exactly
pretty
right.
Crazy.
It's crazy. You know, it's interesting. I had lunch today with a friend of mine who's a professor at a university, and we were talking about people's character, and he was saying that, you know, you meet people who are pretty honest. I mean, like, they're pretty direct, straightforward people. They try to do the right thing as often as they can, and that's kind of one end of the spectrum. And then you have the other end of the spectrum where you have people who really don't care. Like, they don't, it doesn't bother them to lie to you or hurt you or steal from you or manipulate you. It doesn't really do anything to them. It doesn't take anything from them to do those things that we look at as being vices, like real bad, you know, behavior in the world. And he sees it as a spectrum. Like there, you know, are people who follow all along the dots on that line. And I think Kim is like one of those people who is pretty close to 50-50. Like she's a little bit more over. She might be 55-45 or maybe 60-40, but no more than that because she is willing to do some pretty heinous crap.
That's some damn good math, Jamie, on the fly like that.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, but that's the story of all romance, right? Everybody, like, the perfect match for Kim would be a straight-laced, button-down lawyer dude in another firm that's, like, just like her. But no, she wants, the little bit of trouble mixed in that Jimmy provides, the little bit of entertainer, the little bit of difference that spices it up, that makes a pull, pulls her heart towards him.
No, and that's so true. Like, that's true of women. I hate that because, like, I know, like, the kind of guy that's interesting to me. But if I get that guy that's really ideally, like, in my intellectual mind, the perfect guy for me, if you put just a little stank on him, he's more interesting.
All right, Jamie, well, let's jump into this 3-1 Mabel. If you're on a diet, Jamie, do not go to Cinnabon. They unload their sugar by, like, 5-pound bags of pure cane sugar and stack it up in the back room.
I know, and then they have this giant freaking bags of like icing, like 40-pound bags of icing.
Yeah, maybe more than 5 pounds. You're right. Maybe more like 20 pounds or 50-pound bags. It's brutal.
Yeah.
Those are some empty-ass calories. Pretty cool song.
That's correct.
Pretty cool song as Gene unloads his gear and gets ready for his day. Now, he punches a time clock, Jamie. What the hell? Where's the benefits of ownership when you got to punch yourself in?
Well, okay, so I don't think he necessarily owns that Cinnabon. I think he manages the Cinnabon, but I don't think he owns it.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it sucks. It sucks to be Gene. You go from being a guy who is a business owner, who owns, you know, and a prestigious job. You're an attorney. You're on top of the world. You're living the life, man. And then you're anonymous.
Well, he's making 17% laundering Walt's money at, you know, he's bringing in 500 grand every week. He's knocking down 17% of that. And now he's punching a freaking mall time clock for a Cinnabon.
Yeah.
What the hell? Gene is my favorite part of this, though. So that's what happened to him. That's fascinating to me. It's like the whole history of people.
Me too.
What ever happened to Saul? That's what happened to
him. Right, and it's crazy because like now I feel like they're taking the black and white vignette that we all, or at least me, I know for me, like I took that as, oh, here's a little dessert for you. You know, just here, we're going to give you a little flash of, you know, what it might be like for Gene. And, you know, just a little fun thing, right? But this time, it got interesting because there is a plot twist. Something happened that makes us know this thing has to be resolved. And how and when will it be resolved?
Yeah, trouble is inching its way into Gene's safe little life here. We saw last season or season one, I can't remember, where he was locked outside in the garbage department and he was afraid to call the police because there would have been a report generated from it.
Yeah.
But trouble's finding him here. What about this kid and the stolen CDs and him having to be kind of a witness and point him out? And then his legal pull overrides his safety pull and he jumps up and says, don't say a word to the police. Keep silent till you get a lawyer.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. And it makes you wonder if Gene's stuck or if, you know, Saul swam his way back, you know, into into consciousness or something, you know? Not that he's buried him somehow, but sort of, you know?
Yeah, he knows. Remember, he was playing the commercials, the advertising commercials?
I don't mean that legitimately, like seriously. What I mean is that he's trying really hard to suppress, actively and consciously, to suppress that part of himself to stay safe, you know, but he's having trouble, you know, keeping it down.
Yeah, you're right. He has two competing personalities battling within his one body, his sexy Gene body.
That's right.
Jamie, I wonder how he prioritizes his spot in a mall, like where he goes and sits down with his lunch. How does he pick that spot? Where would you sit in a mall like that?
All right. So for me, and oh, by the way, back in the day, I actually did have a job at a mall for like a few months.
Of course you did. We all did.
And I managed a cosmetics counter. And where I went for my break was like inside the employee break room for the store that I worked for. But if I were in a mall like that, I didn't have that. I would probably go to my car or maybe to like if there was a bookstore or something that's attached to the mall. Like, you know, like a Barnes and Noble or something where you could just like sit in a comfy chair and have some silence. Cause I hate all that noise. I don't like them all. I hate them all. And, part of the reason is because there's always, you know, competing noise and competing smells and stuff like that. So, you know, for me, I wouldn't be inside the interior of the mall.
So what do you know about this book he's reading?
Oh, all right. So that book is called The Moon's a Balloon And it was written by the British actor David Niven. And it is a memoir. And it's supposed to be kind of a like a humorous take, you know, like it's, I think it starts off kind of humorous and then gets serious, or it's a humorous take on a tragic tale. It turned out to be a best-selling book. And I think that probably, you know, the reason that, you know, Gene is reading it is because it may have some parallels to his life, you know, as Saul.
Yeah, that must be the implication. I'm having trouble making that connection, but I think you're probably right.
Yeah.
So Gene shouts out legal advice, I guess Jimmy or Saul is the person, the personality, to the kid. He points the kid out in the photo booth to the cops, the mall cop and the real cop. They catch him, and then he yells out, don't talk to them. And then he goes back to work and faints promptly on the floor.
Oh, that's right. He does. And it's crazy because, you know, you're not expecting it. You don't even have that second of swooning where you're like, oh, no, was he going to fall? I mean, he just, like, falls the hell over.
Yeah, I've never fainted, but I guess that's how it works. So you kind of sneaks up on you.
Yeah, fainting is the weird thing.
But this is more evidence of how close Gene is to his being exposed. Like, what happens if he goes to the hospital and they check his medical records or check his insurance and there's no Gene Cinnabon in our, you know, whatever. It's you know, unless that disappearer dude got every single dot dotted and T crossed, who knows what might trip him up. Just something stupid and little, like the garage, or like the garbage scene, or the going to the hospital, or the police needing a report.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the disappearer definitely gave him new IDs and a new social security number and an official name, like that has, you know, that goes with the document. So I don't think the insurance is an issue. But I mean, you're right. I mean, there is a reason why he's trying to keep his head down. There's a reason why he's not just out there living the life of Riley. It's because, you know, he could be discovered. Like, it's not an ironclad identity, not like a real one.
Yeah, it's mysterious. I love it. It's like, what's next? What's going to trip him up? They're hinting that something's going to trip this up and get him caught. We just don't know what it is yet. All right, so this is the up right up to the credits. So the tape recorder fiasco is what's next. It's Jimmy helping his brother Chuck take down the foil. And as he's doing that, he finds Mabel. Mabel's another book in this episode, Jamie, that's somewhat historical, right? It's from 1912, belonged to Granny Davenport, Jimmy and Chuck's Granny Davenport, who used to read it on the Titanic, or the year the Titanic went down. And we also know that Chuck read it to Jimmy when they were little boys. So what's going on here? We all kind of know what's going on, but why does Chuck have this extra foil that he's taking down? That part went over my head.
The extra foil. So he did the whatever that thing is called. I can never think of the name of it. I was going to say Fibonacci function, but whatever the hell that thing is that he made with all the Mylar. I think that, you know, he's taking it down because, I don't know, maybe he's, you know, that he doesn't need that much of it. I don't know. It's confusing to me. I really don't get it. And I really hate that part of the story. Like, it just drives me insane. I would disappear it if I could.
Disappearer? I never liked Chuck. Chuck's like, you will pay. You will pay for this tape recording. You will pay for what you've done to me.
Yeah.
It's this, and there's no, I mean, we learn from Howard later on, I guess we'll get to it, but Chuck talks to Howard. Howard pretty much says, well, so what? What's, you know, this is, you caught him, but there's no way it could be entered into evidence. So what? What does it mean?
Right. And, you know, and Chuck is just so rabidly angry and righteously indignant about his, you know, being wounded by Jimmy that he it is beyond a person's expectation or generosity of spirit to entertain, you know, Chuck's notions about Jimmy. Like, he wears on freaking everybody with that crap.
Yeah, by the way, you're thinking of Faraday cage. I had to research my computer memory. It slipped my mind for a second. Faraday cage that blocks out all electromagnetic and radiation and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, you'll pay. This is bullshit from Chuck. I do not like Chuck.
Me either.
All right, Kim, looks like it's Kim helping, chipping in for Jimmy's absence from the law firm. Like, she's doing the elder law that she's talking to his clients, filling in for him because he's screwing around with Chuck.
Yep.
I don't know. I put in my notes, she's totally underutilized in this private practice. She belongs in a big corporate firm doing the type of stuff that she's been doing with her other people, not this babysitting these elder law wills with ladies with gardens that need names and stuff.
I agree with you, but I think that Kim will thrive anywhere she goes because she's smart and she's freaking tenacious and she's, you know, like, she's tough. But I think you're right. I think she would probably do better in, you know, like a big corporate firm. But, you know, I'll tell you something that's interesting about her for me is that she doesn't seem to be a very happy person. Like, she seems pretty close to damn miserable on the, like, resting pulse scale.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Like, work is her lover. Work is her only fulfillment.
Yeah, it's weird.
She's pretty cold. She's very territorial because she's very cold to his interruption, even though it's with his own clients. He's coming back in late. She's writing a will for these ladies. It's his clients that she's, like, subbing in for him. But she's cold to his interruption. Like, don't interrupt us. We're busy here. And then she actually says later, they're my clients now. This is a business. I'm your partner. I took over. They're my clients now.
Right.
And Jimmy the Charmer storms in, gets their names all wrong. He's thinking of two other ladies. So it's kind of funny. I guess Jimmy being a charmer is sweet and kind of funny.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess in a way, yeah.
Jimmy rubs her shoulders after they leave, and she asks about Chuck, and he says, well, the things we talked about are the thing you never wanted to discuss. So Jimmy helped Kim by doing this job on Chuck with the name address being the wrong address, right? So he helped her, even though he was, like, illegal about it, so she doesn't ever want to talk about it or discuss it. But that's what happened with Chuck and Jimmy, so he tells her that much at least. And Jimmy, you know what I noticed was the post-its all around Kim, the post-its all behind her on her cabinets and stuff. Wait, remember, she would go and put them on the window in the stairwell all around her?
Yeah.
Pretty cool, all the different color post-its.
Yeah, I mean, like, that was that time when she was trying to get herself earn her way out of the basement and being on, what they call that? Law review? Brief? Something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, clerk duty of some kind. Yeah, that was bullshit.
Yeah, some sort of review. But yeah, I mean, you know, they were just giving her busy work to try to, like, make her miserable.
Jimmy's pretty pensive here. He talks about, kind of reflects about Chuck. Like, this is for the first time I can remember, this is 10 minutes that Chuck didn't hate me.
Yeah. And he's, like, so disappointed because he made Chuck angry, you know, at him again. But, I mean, he's got to, like, really sit down and confess to himself that he has no freaking control over that dude. Like, there's no amount of jocularity that Jimmy could impose on a situation that would cause Chuck to not be an ass.
Yeah, I think it's more interesting Jimmy's side of it than Chuck's side of it. Like, do you have older brothers or sisters?
I do. I have two older brothers.
Do they sometimes make you think, wow, they don't get what I really do. Like, they don't appreciate what I'm doing in my career. And do you ever feel that way?
So I have two brothers, and one of them really understands me. And the other one has no idea who I am. Like, no freaking idea. And it's on occasion, I will confess, it is to a frustrating and heartbreaking degree. Because he thinks things of me that are not in any way true.
Yeah, I think it's really hard for younger siblings to escape the orbit of their older siblings. I know the older sibling doesn't usually have malicious intent, but they're older, so they're like, they probably watched you grow up and they took care of you even, and you know that kind of never goes away even when you're up in your 30s and 40s and 50s and beyond. It's like you're still the little sister or little brother.
And so I think, did you have that, Mike?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you always defer to your older sibling.
Just because you, I mean, like, you have a bunch of older brothers, right?
Three.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't ever see myself being any different. Like, I don't see that changing. And I think that's evident in Jimmy and Chuck.
Yeah.
You have a desire to please your older sibling, almost like maybe you might have with a parent. Like, I want to make them proud of me, and I don't want them to. I want them to be proud of what I do and not look down on what I do or not be disappointed in me. It's a fairly substantial burden to manage. It's something tricky to figure out.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's interesting, family relationships like that.
So Chuck and Howard talk about the recording. Chuck's made his way over back now to Hamlin and McGill. And I don't know what Chuck's doing. All I can guess, Jimmy, is he's positioning some wedge between Jimmy and Kim. Or maybe something that might get Kim in trouble or Kim fired. He's trying to leverage something that will make Jimmy feel bad.
Who, Chuck?
Yeah.
I mean, it's always something. I don't think it's really so much the thing as it is the point of, like, he's not going to stop until Jimmy is either no longer himself or that Jimmy is sorry for everything that Chuck perceives Jimmy having done to him.
So what do you think that is? What do you think he can do? Because here he has Howard, smart legal guy, right? Howard telling him, this is all great, but you can't do shit with that tape. It's not worth anything. No judge will ever see it. It'll never be admitted into any evidence. You can't do anything with it. But Chuck's proud of himself. And in fact, he even says, I've already enacted my plans for it. So it's got to hurt somebody. It's got to hurt Kim, maybe. That'll get to Jimmy. Like, get Kim fired or maybe get Kim in some sort of trouble. Get Kim in jail. Who knows?
Yeah. I don't know, man. It's crazy. I whatever it is, though, it's going to be really, really bad because I think it may be the point where Chuck crosses the line and, you know, then everybody's like, all right, dude, Jimmy didn't deserve that, you know?
Yeah, he doesn't deserve any of this shit. It could be the point. It could be the reason we never see Kim in Breaking Bad. It could be the point, the final severance between Jimmy and Kim.
Maybe.
Howard is actually pretty pissed that he wasn't brought in first on whatever. I don't know if Chuck tells him. They don't tell us as the audience what the plan is. But Howard's kind of, I don't know, you got to kind of like Howard for this role. He's kind of like telling Chuck, dude, this is all great, but what's the point? Let's move forward and let's all live happily ever after. But he's pissed now that Chuck's moving on to some other further plan and he wasn't brought in first. Like, it might affect him somehow in the future.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm so uninterested in that part of the story. The only degree to which I'm invested in that at all is like, what the hell is Chuck going to do now? How awful is it going to be?
I want to see something bad happen to Chuck.
I would like to see Chuck ride off into the sunset by tomorrow.
Yeah, not till he does his evil stirrings, though. He's going to do something shitty.
Yeah, I'm waiting.
All right, Mark. Mike hears his car horn in the desert. He's out hunting himself some Salamanca. And he finds the don't note. And thanks to you, Jamie, you reminded me of that, because as I said, I did not rewatch season two. But he backs off of his plan to shoot Hector from 1,000 yards or whatever.
Click.
And he finds the don't note on the car. And it has to be Gus, right? It's very Gus. It's what Gus has done before. It has to be freaking Gus somehow.
That's right.
And he storms off. Mike's angry. He storms off through the desert. How could this happen to me? Who is this? And he stops after a mile or two and storming through the dust and the rain and storm clouds and starts searching around for the tracking device.
Yeah, and he can't find it. That damn thing is well hidden.
That's only a cursory search, though, Jamie, because he pretty soon pulls into a self-serve auto parts place. Have you ever been to one of those places, Jamie?
Self-serve auto parts? No.
Yeah. Well, as a dude talking to a girl, I can be pretty confident to the answer, knowing the answer before I ask that question. Most chicks do not go into self-serve auto parts places. But it's a place where you go. It's like a junkyard. You go, you walk around among all the cars and all the crap, and you find the part for your 1972 Malibu. I need a power steering pump. All right, buddy, there you go. There's 7 acres.
All right.
Go find it. You go and you walk around in the junkyard and you take that part off and you bring it back in and you buy it.
I take it back. I have been in one of those. When I was in college, I dated. Okay, it's like I had love at first sight once in my life. It is a very romantic story. It's an amazing story, and I'll tell it to you one day if you're like really like sleepy or something. but suffice it to say that this was the guy, and he drove a classic old car that he'd inherited from his dad. And it was really hard to find parts for that car. So he would go to this junkyard. And it was exactly the way you're describing it, where he'd go and be like, yeah, do you have, you know, like parts for a 66 Impala? And, you know, the guy would tell him, well, yeah, I got one over here and then I got one over there. And then Billy would just go and like pull whatever part off that he needed and, you know, go pay for it. And that was the thing. Like he'd fix his car with it. So I take it back. I have been in one of those.
He brought you on dates like this?
No. Billy. Okay. So I was in college. We were both like, you know, starving college students. This was the first time I went to college. And, it was awesome because, you know, like we'd just be hanging out. Like Billy was a guy who talked more than me. He talked more than a girl. And we would just drive around. We were poor. We were broke. We didn't have money. And, you know, so we would drive around town and just like, you know, look at stuff or, you know, go get stuff for his car. Like, we spent a lot of time doing stuff with his car, and I don't know, it was awesome.
Well, I can't wait to hear that story. So some stuff that guys notice that maybe girls don't notice that was pretty awesome in this little scene at the forklift or at the junkyard was the forklift of the whole freaking car. Like,
yeah.
One of those big auto forklifts that lifts the whole thing up and throws it into the crusher. Well, they lift it up so Mike can work on the car and go underneath it. It was just pretty freaking dangerous, Jamie. First of all, it's a big-ass car. It's a big old station wagon car, pretty freaking heavy. It's lifted up by a forklift. That means it doesn't have support all around evenly, and the forklift's standing on the dirt of the junkyard, not on, like, concrete or cement. It's, like, pretty dangerous to do it that way. But it's cool as freaking hell.
Yeah, I mean... Okay, so it was, like, amazing, but, I mean, now that you're talking about all that a danger, it's weirding me out because that's a lot of risk.
And then they set the car down on wheels, like wheels without tires on them, as the jack stands, not even real jack stands, just wheels positioned on the ground to keep the car wheels up off the ground. So Mike, I don't know why, I guess he could take the wheels off and get a little bit better view underneath from the car being closer to the ground.
Yeah, probably.
But he continues to look, Jamie. He looks everywhere for hours and hours till the junkyard closes and just lays that car to waste.
Yeah, that's right.
There's no putting that thing back together. That was a total one-way job of take it apart till I find the frickin' tracker.
Yeah, that was a Humpty Dumpty car.
He's shredding the seats and everything.
Yup.
So the guy calls him a cab. Now, you reminded me, Jamie, we were talking about this earlier, the junkyard guy where they did the magnet trick on the thing that they pull in season 5. They crushed the big RV.
Uh-huh.
That guy was awesome. The junkyard lawyer.
He was. Okay, so I got to tell you something that I heard in this episode. Do not let me forget. For not this scene with Mike, but the next scene with Mike. Don't let me forget. It's really interesting.
All right, well, Mike is waiting for his cab in the retail store part of the junkyard. He notices the gas cap display, Jamie.
That's right.
And he looks at it like, oh, there's models for almost every car. And he asks the guy, do you have a model for a 72 Impala wagon? And the guy says, yeah, of course, on the bottom row or whatever. But yeah, there's a gas cap. You can buy a replaceable gas cap for every kind of car. And this is where Mike puts it all together in his head. This is where the frickin' bug is going to be, because it clicks for him now. It's easily replaceable. It's indiscernible. No one's going to ever suspect a gas cap. And you take it off and put it on in 2 seconds, and there you go. You just replace it. Nobody will ever know the difference.
Yeah.
So
I'm sorry, go ahead.
He gets home and does the same check on his daily car, his daily driver car, his regular car, and sees the same deal, same gas cap, he knows what's going on now. And then we get some very slow, deliberate scenes of him taking apart the gas cap and figuring out the tracker.
All right, so that was one of those scenes that I loved. Like this one, for the way it was shot, it was really freaking gorgeous. So Mike is sitting at the table and he's got that magnifying lens, you know, that's like over one of his eyes. And he's holding the tracker in one hand, and in the other, he is penciling onto a notepad the serial number of this device. And it's just the way it's shot is so pretty because, you know, you see Mike just kind of, like leaning over, and then the magnifying glass is, you know, like his, you know, the like the next more noticeable thing on the page. And then, you know, I'm sorry. Like, yeah, like he's writing the serial number, and you can see the notebook reflected in the magnifying glass. Did you notice that?
Yeah, it was pretty cool. You know at this point that Mike has formulated his whole plan. He just discovered what's going on, like, within an hour ago, and yet he's formulated his whole plan, what he's going to do and what he's going to do next and next and next. It's just awesome.
Yes, it is. It's like, freaking amazing. But that's why I love Mike so much. That's why his part of the story is more compelling to me than, like, you know, than the other parts of the story. It's just his stuff. It has more urgency, and he's so cool. And, you know, like, you could see, I mean, really seriously, sometimes I really go back and forth on, like, whether this thing should be really about him. You know, Mike is just interesting. He's freaking interesting.
He is really interesting. He's a great character.
So in that, is it that scene? It's not that scene. It's probably the next one. But that one was the one where, like, I realized when he's writing down the serial numbers, he's getting ready to order something. Like,
yeah, he's five steps ahead. He knows he needs one of his own because he knows what he's going to do next. He's not writing down the serial number to give it to somebody and say, hey, tell me what this is. He knows exactly what it is. He wants one of his own, and he wants to flip it on who's ever playing this tracking game on him.
Right, exactly.
So we jump to Jimmy now, back to his office. All the female customers are charmed to hell by Jimmy. He's talking to some lady who admits at the end of their meeting that she used Lilies of the Valley, Jamie, at her granddaughter's wedding.
Yeah, that was a reference.
Yep, so the writers are connecting all the dots for us.
Yeah, I like that. I thought that was so good.
So Jimmy can charm almost just about everybody in his office except for the Air Force captain, who takes offense at what Jimmy did with his advertising video on his base.
Yeah, so, yeah, the captain is really wounded. He's really upset, like genuinely, sincerely upset. And he's a straight arrow kind of, you know, straight and narrow kind of guy. And what Jimmy has done is offensive to his very core. Like, he is offended, you know, and it's that Fudge dude, that old veteran Fudge.
Fudge Talbot, war hero. And the guy pushes back. Are you freaking kidding me? That was a fake. There is no Fudge Talbot. They worked in so many comedic little sentences in this little exchange. It's so funny. Jimmy calls the plane a B-52, and the captain's like, Fifi is a B-29. He's all indignant that he gets the model of the plane wrong. The plane was called Fifi.
You know what's crazy? Like, I'll tell you, so much crap has gone on in the over a year since that aired. Like, that, the last episode of last season, or the episode that we called Fifi. I just remembered Vince Gilligan talking about that plane. Like, Vince has a thing about, like, planes, like old planes. And last year when they did the Insider podcast, he talked about that plane. Like, he has a special relationship with that plane, and that's why he had that particular B-29 on the show.
Yeah, he was going to get a ride in it at an air show or something.
Yeah, like, he loves that plane. He's been, like, to see it a couple times or something.
So the Air Force captain says, you lied to me. I can't let you get away with it. Take your ad down or there'll be hell to pay. And Jimmy's lawyerness kicks in a little bit here, and he says, try it. You're the one that let me on the base and let me in there to do whatever I did.
He says, make me. And yeah. I just thought that was just, it was so, like, bringing out, like, that moment to me, that felt like he was waking the sleeping giant, basically. Like, the captain was, you know, he's jostled Jimmy too much, and he's gotten, like, the id, you know, of Jimmy to wake up, and now watch out, dude.
Well, make me take it down is the macho id. Try it. You let me on the base is the strategy of a lawyer, the smart counterpoint of a lawyer saying, you could tell everybody that I did something wrong, but you're the one that let me on the base to do it. So you're going to get in trouble if you try to get me in trouble. Like, he's smart. It's smart and funny and macho and all that kind of mixed together.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jimmy throws a monkey wrench into all of this, Jimmy, by kind of switching personalities with this captain and Chuck. He presents words to Chuck instead of the captain. Like, he switches them around and says, you're always on your high horse trying to make me think I'm not as good as you. And he makes the captain into Chuck, like it's a mind, like it's like he's going insane or something.
Yeah, that was really disturbing, and I didn't like that at all. It was shocking and upsetting, and I think it was shocking and upsetting to Jimmy and probably also to the captain.
Do you think there's some sort of a blockage of Jimmy McGill, like, in becoming Saul Goodman? Like, it's a, like an, I don't know, personality twist, insanity, some sort of a mental problem? Or do you think that's a possibility here?
I do. I wonder about it. And especially since Jean passed out, I wonder if, like, Jimmy saw Jean, has, like, some sort of slowly growing brain tumor. I'll tell you something crazy. I have a cousin who, like, struggled for years and years and years with infertility, like 20 years. And she and her husband spent a fortune on fertility treatments. And they finally gave up and just decided, like, okay, we're just going to adopt because we can't get this baby. Like, we can't, you know, get pregnant. And so they ended up adopting. But in the meantime, my cousin worked for a neurologist. Like, she managed his practice. And he told her one day, you know, I hate these doctors who are supposed to be scientists, but they don't have enough curiosity to try to figure out why you're having this struggle. And so he did, like, an MRI on her and discovered that she had a very extremely slowly growing brain tumor. And it wasn't, you know, cancerous. Like, it was benign. But she has to take medication every day for the rest of her life in order to keep this thing from growing and killing her.
Hmm. Well, I don't think this is a one-off like that with Jimmy. Because, you know, Chuck has this freaking electromagnetism where he needs to live in a fucking Faraday cage. It's like the McGill boys have both this mental that you got to call Chuck's problem a mental illness. And maybe Jimmy has the same thing. Maybe it's something in the McGill gene pool.
Perhaps.
Or something their parents forced on them or who knows what. But they seem to share this mental instability somehow.
Yeah, you're right. I wonder if that's going to turn out to be something.
So just to put the punctuation on the, you lie in the bed that you make, the Army guy or the Air Force guy says, is the wheel's going to turn. It always does. Like, you're going to have to deal with the repercussions of what you've set up in your life. There are, you know, consequences.
Yeah.
And then he storms out with a little bit more comedy, like, a lawyer you can trust, my ass. He, like, kind of downplays Jimmy in front of the whole waiting room of people.
Appropriately, uh-huh.
And Jimmy says, thank you for your service.
Yeah, right.
All right, Mike's doing his crossword at the parking lot booth, Jamie, and he's ready to put his follow-up on the gas cap caper into play. So he puts the gas cap from his car on the wall, very reminiscent about the way he put his keys up on the airport parking wall on the top of the wall there when he had his go bag in his car at the airport parking lot.
Wow.
Exact same thing. He couldn't really see it. He had to kind of reach up there and just feel around. Okay, this is a good spot. Nobody will find it here. Uh-huh. And he goes and meets one of the many comedians of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, Jamie, Joe DeRosa.
Yep.
So we have Bob Odenkirk, of course. We have Joe DeRosa. Lavelle Crawford was Huel. And Bill Burr was QB. Uh-huh. Tons of great comedians in this show.
That's true.
And they're good actors.
Yeah, that's correct. I love that stuff. I think that's great. I think it's probably due to, you know, Odenkirk having those connections.
Yeah, or maybe Gilligan. Gilligan's is loving comedy.
Yeah, well, yeah. And Vince Gilligan is responsible for that, too. He said, you know, he got approached by Bill Burr. Like, Bill Burr, like, wrote a note to the show or something, or wrote a note to Vince Gilligan and was like, hey, I love Breaking Bad. You know, if you ever have a role for me, would you please work it in, you know, so that I can be on there. And that's how he ended up on there. But, I mean, he was great. Comedy gold, man.
And he was not really that funny in his role either. He had a couple roles. He was the truck driver on the train caper.
Uh-huh.
And he was the water quality inspector in the car wash purchase.
Right, and he was Kooby the whole time, and of course he was there when, when Ted Beneke, you know, had his famous slide
That was probably the most comedic of the three, even though that's horrible. Ted snapped his neck in that one, but it's like, what we're going to do? Walking. We're walking to the table. We're going to sign the FedEx papers, and now we're going to be here, unless there's no cable, and then the weekend's going to seem like freaking forever.
Yep, that's right. Funny. Yeah, I loved it.
Anyway, he goes to meet Joe DeRosa. Joe DeRosa is the veterinarian who gets his deals in underworld dealings in addition to being a veterinarian. He meets him at 3:30 a.m., Jamie, in the switching yard somewhere to get him a duplicate tracker from that number he wrote down from the magnifying glass.
That's right. And he's all like, how much is it? And Joe DeRosa's like, dude, how am I supposed to know? It cost you what it cost me plus my fee.
Yeah, he says, normally about 500, but since it's after hours and this is a house call, let's make it 1,000.
Yeah.
And then he says, how's the pup? So he reminds us that he's a vet.
Well, yes. Yes.
Because as you remember, he gave Mike a dog that Mike gave to his granddaughter.
Yeah.
Pretty cool that the guy's really a vet. Not just like posing to be a vet. He's really a vet.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah. I knew he was a vet.
And he's really concerned about the dog. Sounded pretty sincere with that question.
Yeah, and I guess it was also probably a good bit of writing from the writers so that we could place him and, you know, remember how he got on the scene.
Yeah, a good historical recreation of Joe DeRosa.
Yeah.
So next scene is Kim at Mesa Verde in the lobby with her old friend Paige. She's cleaning up the mess, the McGill mess. Paige is still upset that Chuck fucked up the address and got everything screwed up. But Kim has been working overtime, Jamie. She's written letters. She's got the hearing moved up 3 weeks. She's really impressing Paige here with her details and her diligence to this case.
That's right. She is not messing around.
And Paige is still very, very mad at Chuck. She remembers she's just muddying the waters. And, like, she is mad at that dude.
Well, yeah. I mean, okay, so here's the thing. Like, when you're a woman working in the corporate world, there's a lot of misogyny. There's a lot of sexism. And men do tend a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times to treat women like we are the reason for any mistake. Or we're, you know, the reason for the problem. Or, you know, like, look at, you know, what's happening in the news these days. Like, there are a lot of women who are being treated like objects, you know, by people. And that, it's common. You know, I got propositioned by two married men this past week at work. Like, this past week and the week before, two married men at my job. I mean, like, how crazy do you have to be to do something like that? Like, women, you wouldn't believe the crap we go through.
Yeah, that's bad. Well, it's in Paige's case, it's guys just like, we're the major leagues. You're just, you know, you're just bit players in this. So I'll handle this. You're just muddying the waters.
Right, exactly. I mean, okay, so like this dude today, one of the same guys who thought so little of himself and me as to proposition me when he's got a family and a wife, right? This dude sends me an email today at work and asks me to put something on his calendar like I'm his freaking secretary. I mean, it's just, why?
I don't know. Maybe because he can, or he thinks he can.
He thinks he can, but he can't. So, I mean, you know, I don't know. People have a lot of damn nerve. And, like, the stuff women go through, like, she was offended, you know, because that's, and coming from Chuck, you know, it had that extra bit of ugly on it because, you know, he's got all that ego and, you know, he's telling her she's muddying the waters. And in fact, you know, it was Jimmy. It was Jimmy who did it. But, you know, Paige, you know, had nothing to do with the problem, you know?
Yeah, and Chuck's comment, it didn't matter who was really guilty of the problem, just to say to anyone, look, you're just muddying the waters. I'll handle this, baby. That's right. Like not cool. Even if you are handling it, you could be more professional about it.
That's right.
And then Paige also says the guys like that always blame somebody else for things. So I don't know what foretelling that is of the future, but Jamie, mm-hmm. Kim wants that document portfolio back until tomorrow to double check everything. And then she ends up like rereading it and retyping a colon and a semicolon and a dash. And she's stressed over every little intimate detail. I think probably because of the address being wrong, she didn't want to leave herself open to the similar type of mistake.
Well, not only that, but I think she's having an existential moment. You know, like she feels guilty. You can see it on her face. In that conversation with Paige, you can see her wincing. You can see her being like, oh, shit, you know, because she knows the truth of what happened. Like she knows that that was not, it didn't play out the way that Paige understood it, right? That Mesa Verde understood it. Like she knows. And it's hard for her to.
She knows the truth, yeah.
Yeah, like to really cognizantly. Consciously deceive this woman who holds her in high regard.
And given her such a big opportunity, like in her career, this could be huge for Kim.
Yeah.
All right, so while she's back in her office going over the document again, Jimmy paints over the rainbow. And it looks like things are good between Jimmy and Kim. They're almost ready to leave and go out and do something together, I think. It was like implied they were going to be together and everything was okay. But Kim has more edits, and Jimmy goes right back to painting because he knows her so well that more edits means I'll be just a second, means probably another hour at the computer.
Yeah, well, okay, so a couple things. Like, that edit thing was, like, really enjoyable for me because of that. Like, I do that. I mean, believe me. I mean, like, I will have a moment where I'm like, okay, so that, you know, that should be, you know, a dash that should, or not really a dash, but like a, like an M dash, or that should be, you know, a semicolon because, you know, of this construction and, you know, what the meaning is and, you know, all that stuff. Like those are the kinds of conversations that writers have, you know, and that editors have with writers. And it's, I really completely identified with that. I smiled and smiled and smiled at her doing that because I've done it a million times.
Do you think there's any symbolism to the half rainbow? Like half measure of some sort? Or why did he only make it halfway, like almost perfectly 50% through painting that rainbow out?
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I think that the halfway has got to be some sort of metaphor. And particularly since it was a subtractive move, you know, it was originally a full rainbow. And, you know, then, you know, that, you know, now it's subtracted. And so, I think it's got some symbolism to it. And maybe it's a little sign of foreboding. Yeah, that would be my guess.
So Ernie brings Ice over to Chuck's. Now, Jamie, do you think Ernie is Gus's son, like the rest of the internet does?
No, I don't.
He does kind of look like Gus.
I think that's silly. I don't think Ernie is Gus's son.
He's kind of soft-spoken and polite like Gus.
Gus is from another country. Ernie was like born in America, and the ages are not appropriate. Ernie is like 20 maybe. And, you know, Gus at that point in time would have been a bit young.
Well, Jamie, there's another show you might have heard about it called The Americans, and they're from another country and their kids are American and they look very American, even though the frickin' Americans are Russian.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't know. You just called the internet a bunch of idiots, like, for thinking that. And I don't know if you exactly said idiot, but I think you think it's stupid, and I think it's stupid too.
No, I didn't call them idiots. I said the whole internet is thinking this. Maybe yeah. I said knuckleheads or dopes or something. Maybe you're right.
I don't know if you qualified it, but it sounded to me like you thought it was pretty damn dumb.
You're hearing things in your own head.
I am. I fell asleep like earlier when I was describing the thing with Mike. I started sleep talking. I do that sometimes when I'm really tired.
Kind of like what Jimmy did with the Air Force captain. You displaced another person for who you were really trying to talk to.
No, no. I sleep talk. Like, if I'm really extremely tired, I will be having a conversation, but in my mind, I'm dreaming, and what's coming out is part conversation and part dream.
Oh, I know it, Jamie. Just go back and listen to Better Call Saul 208 on West Coast Project.
Huh?
Just kidding.
Oh.
All right, Ernie brings us ice and also brings a special delivery in his normal grocery package of batteries for the tape recorder. Chuck asks him, because he doesn't want to touch the electronic tape recorder, to put the batteries in for him, or he doesn't want to touch the batteries, whatever. And Jamie, it starts up unexpectedly, and it starts right at the part where Jimmy is caught, like, in the lie of the, or caught in the caper of the address lie. So Chuck wanted Ernie to hear this, obviously. And he dictates confidentiality law to him, like, you cannot ever repeat this, kind of reinforcing that he has to repeat it to Jimmy.
So what, I mean, but what is that going to do?
I don't know. Chuck's whole plan is a mystery. It's a mystery to Howard.
Yeah.
It's a mystery to me. I don't know. But he's setting things up to pull a trigger later. And one of them is Ernie knowing this tape exists that he can then go back to Jimmy and tell him. And I think Chuck, that's exactly what Chuck wants him to do.
Probably.
It's the only reason it could be in there. It's really the only reason. It's not an accident that Ernie heard this.
Hmm. You know, that's interesting because I did not think that at all. And that makes perfect sense.
Well, what did you think?
I thought it was an accident, and I thought Chuck was just being an asshole, and I don't know. Chuck just, ugh.
Well, clearly, you clearly can't put it past Chuck to be a devious planner like that.
No, I think it makes perfect sense. I'm just saying it never occurred to me. That's, like, surprising to hear you reasoning that. And I'm delighted that you figured it out because I had no idea.
All right, so the next scene is Mike now reading his new MTSAR RF-65 manual, Jamie. It's his new bugged tracker that he's ordered through Joe DeRosa. It's arrived now. He's got it in his hands.
That's right.
And so you grasp the whole caper here. He replaces his bug gas cap with a new one that he got from Joe DeRosa. And then he runs down the battery of the old one because he can't just take the battery out because he tested his new one. And when he took the battery out, it showed it on the screen as somebody's fucking with the battery.
Oh.
So he has to run the battery down, like, generically, like, without suspicion being aroused.
Like, naturally. Okay.
Yeah, so he plugs a radio. If you notice, he plugged those little jumper cables into the tracker without separating the battery. Kind of insert.
Damn, Mike.
And that's why, because he needs to leave the battery connected and run it down faster. So then he has a beer and he goes and, like, lets the battery run down by the radio playing.
All right, so here's the part where I was, like, telling you, don't let me forget. The voice that was on there was that toilet dude. Oh, you're a big boy. Remember that toilet dude?
Yeah, vaguely. How did you make that connection?
I heard it. That voice is stuck in my mind. I can never forget it. And it just had that tinge to it. And I was like, that is that freaking toilet dude. It is.
Well, Mike's plan works because he goes on pistachio watch and sits by the window and watches the car with the now dead battery in it, or with the gas cap with his new battery, his new tractor, and he's got them thinking it's got a dead battery. So they show up, they swap it out, they take the old tracker that they think is the old tracker. It's really Mike's new tracker, which is going to lead him right to probably Gus, right?
Yeah.
Whoever they are, it's going to lead him back to him, lead him back to them, and that's probably Gus.
That's right.
So, Jamie, have you ever done this type of undercover work at night?
Yes. No.
Oh my God. What did you do?
All right. Truth be told, one time I had a cheating, no good boyfriend, and I went and camped outside a place that I knew he was and waited
you
for him.
You stalker!
Now, this was way back. Like, I was in my teens. I was probably 19 when I did this. But, yeah, I did.
Well, I actually did it with a car. I kind of did it like Mike in my life. I had a car. I had a Mustang convertible in college, and it broke down, and so it was sitting in the parking lot for, like, weeks. So people would come by and steal parts off of it at night. So me and my roommates actually got into another car in the parking lot, and we loaded up with beer and, like, snacks and stuff, and we watched. But we all got drunk and fell asleep.
Oh,
so we weren't as good as Mike Ehrmantraut. We didn't do very good surveillance. But anyway, this guy comes, takes the new bug, leaves, and Mike follows him, and I guess we're going to see where. But that's the end of the episode of 301 yeah. Mabel.
It's awesome.
Next episode, Jamie, did you watch any Nextons for it?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I forget the name of it. Shoot, I thought I wrote it down here. But I did watch the Nextons. Nextons, by the way, started with a Victoria's Secret commercial.
Really?
So that must be the demo of the people watching Better Call Saul.
Huh.
But anyway, there's sleeping guys in a car in a power plant, and a truck drives up with coffee to wake them up, and he swaps the tracker out.
Ah.
So they show the truck driver. So the guy's sleeping in the car, get the coffee. The truck driver is the new guy. They show him the tracker screen, and they exchange the bug with him. And Mike watches all of this kind of in the distance from the dark around the corner at the power plant with his new tracker in hand.
Yeah, man, Mike.
Then there's another next on where they show Gus at Pollos Hermanos.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we might see him next episode.
Yeah, I think
all right, Jamie, that's about all I got for Mabel.
Well, that was a great episode, and I think we did a great podcast just now.
You got any ways for people to reach you if they have things they want to say to wish I said that shit?
All right, so I haven't done my blogging this week, but I'll do it in a couple of days. Maybe I'll do it tomorrow. But yes, on the website, wishisaidthatshit.com, that is where I write my thoughts about things that I wish I'd said during the podcast that I can't, you know, go back and fix, because once it's done, it's done. And then I'm also on Twitter. I'm at Word Girly.
And I'm at Scathing Tweets. And you can find all of this stuff on West Coast Project. We do The Americans. We're about to do Fargo. Other stuff we do is all listed in the catalog on westcoastproject.com. So go there to find us. And Jamie, actually, let me look it up here. I hate not knowing the next frickin' episode.
Okay, so while you're doing that, I will pump you guys. Mike does a great podcast on Fargo.
I hate when you do this, by the way. I know it's really sweet of you, but I hate this. Glorious.
Why?
Because it's kind of, you don't need to.
Okay, well then I will just say that Fargo premieres on April 19th.
Tell Michelle she's good.
Michelle is awesome.
Because she is good.
I love Michelle, and Michelle is Mike's other podcast partner, and she's gorgeously beautiful and really sweet, and she has a great Southern lilt to her voice, and she's wonderful and
Michelle
smart.
From Tennessee.
That's correct.
All right, the next episode is Mijo. No, sorry, wrong season. Mijo. I don't know, I might not be able to go this far. Mabel, witness number 2, 302.
Awesome.
You want to go through them all? Here's what I know about the future episodes, Jamie. Number 2, witness. Number 3, sunk costs. I love the sunken cost theory, or the sunken cost fallacy, it actually is.
Yeah. Like the more you invest into something, like you really want to get your money out of it or something.
Yeah, like I'm going on a diet tomorrow, but you know what? I got a whole dozen donuts in the fridge. I can't throw them away because I still got them. I already paid the money for them. Bullshit. You should just throw them away. That's sunken cost. You can't recoup it.
Ah.
Number four, sabrosito.
Hmm.
I don't know what that is. Pabrosito is poor little one. Number five, chicanery. Number six, off-brand. Number seven, expenses. That's all I have. That's all I got, Jamie.
Pretty awesome.
That would take us all the way up to almost June. Can you believe it?
No.
Where's the frickin' time going?
It goes, man.
All right, Jamie, we spent enough time here tonight, so I'll see you next week on Witness.
Awesome. Great podcast, Mike.
Bye.
Bye.